From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now. Today, the Trump administration imposed new sanctions on several wealthy Russians and government officials, the latest in the tit-for-tat with Moscow after its interference in the 2016 U.S. election. President Trump also doubled down on his threats against China, saying he would levy tariffs on another $100 billion in its imports.
And there are more doubts today about the future of EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. The New York Times is reporting that at least five EPA officials either resigned, were demoted, or asked for new jobs after they questioned Pruitt's spending at the agency. Pruitt's been under the microscope for housing arrangements he made with the wife of an energy lobbyist, his first-class travel arrangements, and a proposal to spend about $70,000 to replace two desks in his office. Last night aboard Air Force One, President Trump backed up his top environmental deregulator.
Scott has done a fantastic job. I think he's a fantastic person. I just left coal and energy country. They love Scott Pruitt. They feel very strongly about Scott Pruitt, and they love Scott Pruitt.
Let's bring in our roundtable. Beth Fooey is senior politics editor at NBC. Hi, Beth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. And Jesse Holland, who reports for the Associated Press. Jesse, welcome.
How you doing today?
Fine, thanks. Jesse, how close is Scott Pruitt to looking for a new job?
I think we're on what, maybe, I'm looking at my watch now, so we got, how long until 4:30? Yeah. It seems like we get the big news from the Trump administration on Fridays, and it seems also seems like Scott Pruitt's on his last days. We don't know anything for a fact. You never can tell with the Trump administration, but whenever the president starts calling you a good man, when the president starts praising you, you can almost start, it's code, y'all. You can almost start the stopwatch from that point. So it would not surprise me if we hear something by the end of the day, but it may go on till next week as well.
And there's something else that figures into this, and that's that Scott Pruitt on Wednesday spoke with Ed Henry of Fox News, something that President Trump didn't like too much. Let's hear it.
President Trump said he would drain the swamp.
I don't
look. Is draining the swamp renting an apartment from the wife of a Washington lobbyist?
I don't think that that's even remotely fair to ask that question.
Really?
I have access.
President Trump attacked lobbyists every day of the week on the campaign trail.
What is being done in substance to attack that? What is being done at this agency and across the federal government? That's exactly right. And so when you see, look what we've done in cost savings.
The president is said not to be too happy with the way Scott Pruitt did in that interview. So what kind of a spot does this put the president in? He's saying that they have a good relationship, and Scott Pruitt is one of his best deregulators. Beth?
Well, and that is the issue here. I mean, unlike some of the other people who've been fired from the Trump administration, Tom Price, for example, the former HHS secretary who was flying around on those expensive flights, Scott Pruitt really has made good on the Trump administration promise to cut regulations around the environment. Trump is not wrong. Pruitt is not wrong in what he just said to Ed Henry. They changed the emission standards so that cars under the Obama administration had been en route to having to improve their gas mileage by 2025. That rule has been rolled back. Coal, of course, the Trump administration is very much in favor of coal production, and Pruitt's been part of that. The administration pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. All the things that Trump promised around the issue of deregulation on environmental matters, Pruitt has been right there, and he is very popular among conservatives for that reason. So what's become of this this particular spat around Pruitt is that many conservatives see this as a war on Pruitt ideologically by liberals rather than a drain the swamp issue that he's taking advantage of the government. And as long as it's framed that way, it's going to be very hard for President Trump to get rid of him because it will look like the liberals have sort of, you know, bagged a scalp, a scalp that is very popular among conservatives.
Jesse, what do you think about that? As Beth just pointed out, there is a ton of news coming out of the EPA.
Well, one of the things you also have to keep in mind is that, like Beth said, once you're popular with the conservatives, it's going to be more difficult that for the president to do anything to you. Jeff Sessions is still attorney general after all the things that President Trump has said about him. But Jeff Sessions has done the things that the president and the conservatives wanted. He's pushed back on immigration. He's pushed back on the Obama administration's push to reform police departments. Scott Pruitt's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
He's following the agenda that the conservatives want. He's pushing back on these regulations. They're changing some of the standards that came from the Obama administration. It's going to be difficult for the president to do something to him, given that he's doing what the conservatives want. But you never know with the Trump administration. He might, if Scott Pruitt continues to be the news for another news cycle, he might not have a choice.
You just mentioned quickly. You just mentioned Jeff Sessions, so I want to bring up this tweet that the president put out today. He said, "Do you believe that the fake news media is pushing hard on a story that I am going to replace AG Jeff Sessions with EPA Chief Scott Pruitt, who is doing a great job but is totally under siege?" Beth?
Yeah, well, our reporting from NBC News is that President Trump has definitely mused about replacing Sessions with Pruitt. Pruitt is a lawyer, as we know. He's the Attorney General of Oklahoma. He's also been confirmed by the Senate already, so it would be fairly easy to slide him into that position if President Trump chose to do so. However, at this point, from our understanding, from our reporting, is that it's really just musing. President Trump does tend to sort of speak aloud his thoughts, and the folks around him feel that that's exactly what he was doing. He was just sort of musing. It wasn't an intent to absolutely do it. And that now that Pruitt is under so much pressure and it's under the Klieg lights of this bad publicity, President Trump has lightly backed off from that.
There's a lot to consider in this, as well as the fact that there are people waiting to be confirmed by Congress, including Mike Pompeo, nominated to take Rex Tillerson's place as Secretary of State. So issues of governmental functionality come into play here as well. Also, let's talk about the tariff story, which keeps on developing. President Trump's move to impose even stronger tariffs on Chinese imports, $100 billion. Here was the president this morning on WABC Radio.
We've already lost the trade war. We don't have a trade war. We've lost the trade war. The easiest thing for me to do would be just to close my eyes and forget it. If I did that, I'm not doing my job. So I'm not saying there won't be a little pain, but the market's gone up 40%, 42%, so we might lose a little bit of it. But we're going to have a much stronger country when we're finished.
China said today it will fight back with a major response. A lot of Trump supporters say that they're willing to wait this one out. They don't mind taking a hit in the stock market if Donald Trump can figure out this trade imbalance. Jesse, what do you have to say about this?
Well, the interesting thing about it is that a lot of these tariffs that the administration is talking about, they're going to rebound and hit the red states harder than anywhere else. Because when you start talking about how China's going to respond, they're going to respond in tariffs that are going to hurt a lot of the middle of America, a lot of the agricultural community, and a lot of the factory community that still survives in America.
But Donald Trump knows that. I mean, is he not afraid of the consequences?
Apparently not, because it doesn't seem like this most recent round of $100 billion tariffs, he even ran past anybody. It just seems like he came up with this and he's moving on his own without consulting anyone. There are a lot of Republicans who say they're going to sit back and wait, but I guarantee you the farm state Republicans are not sitting back and waiting, because this is going to hit them directly.
Beth, which country, China or the United States, is more vulnerable in this fight?
Yeah. Well, I think the issue of vulnerability is really around the issue of strategy. President Trump doesn't seem to have a real strategy around this. I mean, there's no question that China has taken advantage of or defied a lot of the terms of the World Trade Organization in terms of intellectual property theft. There's lots of bad action coming out of that gigantic country, that gigantic economy, and policymakers have been complaining about it for many, many years. This is not just unique to President Trump. However, the fact that he goes out and he says, we're going to do this, and yet then his top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, comes out and sort of cleans up after him in interviews afterwards, saying, well, you know, we're still working on this. We're going to work out a negotiation with the Chinese. The tariffs haven't even been imposed yet. We don't want pain. We don't want anybody to feel pain. Those are all things that he said this morning, reacting to the president's announcement of the increased tariffs. So there just doesn't seem to be a logical way that the administration plans to go about doing this in a way that actually shuts down China's bad behavior while at the same time protecting our economy over the short, medium and long term.
You know, we also heard from Kudlow that he didn't hear about the latest proposal for tariffs until just last night.
Right. That speaks to the lack of strategy that I was saying.
I want to talk about one more thing happening today. Evangelical leaders are sitting down with the president to talk about Stephanie Clifford's, also known as Stormy Daniels, and the allegations that his lawyer, Michael Cohen, paid the porn star $130,000 to keep quiet about the affair that is alleged that she had with the president. I wonder if you can tell us, Donald Trump says that he does not know where that money to make the payment come from. He said so last night. Clifford's claim is that this nondisclosure agreement is null and void because the president never signed it and he wasn't part of it. What do you think, Jesse, in terms of where this is going and how much it comes back to roost with the president?
Well, one of the things that we're going to see is that we're going to see how important results are for evangelical leaders. They've said in the past that the reason why they support Donald Trump is because Donald Trump was going to get them results. Well, he's gotten a Supreme Court justice for them. They're getting a bunch of justices on the appeals court. How are they going to be able to go back to their evangelical voters in the midterm and say, you should vote on morals when they are trying to figure out what Donald Trump is doing with Stormy Daniels? So it's going to be interesting seeing their reactions after this meeting, especially since it's
Jesse, I got to cut
clearer.
You off. I'm sorry. Jesse Allen from the AP and Beth Fooey, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Russia's foreign minister is urging Britain to produce its evidence in the poisoning of an ex-Russian spy in the UK. Britain says Russia was responsible for the nerve agent attack on the spy and his daughter back in March. It is a charge that Moscow denies. Meantime, there is growing debate inside Great Britain about the case. The opposition Labour Party wants an investigation into whether Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson misled the public about Russian involvement in the poisoning. Sir Kim Derrick is the United Kingdom's ambassador to the United States, and he joins us now in the studio. Ambassador, welcome. And as we said, Russia says it was not behind this attack. Is your government 100% sure that the nerve agent came from Russia?
We absolutely are. The Russians are the ones who make nerve agents, and they have a track record of doing that. And Novichok, which is the one was used in this case, was made back in the 1980s, military-grade agent. They have a track record of using nerve agents, and they have a track record of state-sponsored assassinations. Add all of that together, not just us, but in the Court of International Opinion, because I think 28 countries have taken action against Russia. There's no doubt in our minds of their culpability.
No doubt whatsoever.
No doubt.
As you know, there was a storm this week over a tweet that the UK Foreign Office deleted, which said that the nerve agent was created in Russia. So why delete the tweet, if you're so sure?
That tweet was just misinterpreted, I think. That all comes from this story about the senior scientist at Porton Down, which is our chemical weapon
laboratory.
Yeah. Saying that he couldn't prove that Russia was responsible. And, I mean, the truth about this is that's only a small part of the picture of what we know about what has happened and why we believe Russia was culpable. It was never the job of Porton Down to assess whether, to do a kind of Sherlock Holmes thing on who was responsible. It was their job to establish that it was Novichok, which is made by the Russians. There's intelligence and other sources of information which also point the finger towards Russia. So you've got to put the whole picture together establish culpability.
And that's what we've done. It did give Russia ammunition then to step up and say, look, see, they're not so sure after all. I mean, it opens the door to some doubt.
We're sure. I mean, tweets come and go, but we are sure, and so have all our friends and allies been around the world, and there's no question about this.
Do you think it goes right to the top, to the Kremlin?
I wouldn't be able to say that, we certainly suspect that something like this would not have happened without the Russian state, one way or another, signing off on it.
Now, after the expulsion of Russian diplomats around the world in response to this, there have been many comparisons to the Cold War. You know, that word has come up a lot. Of course, I don't need to tell you that's a very dangerous time in history. Is it worth it to escalate it to that level? And do you agree with those comparisons?
Look, we don't use language about return of a Cold War. What we do say is that Russia is behaving outside all the accepted standards of international behavior, whether in what it's doing in Ukraine, whether it's in its takeover of Crimea, whether it's what it's doing in Syria or what it's done in Salisbury, England. So for us, it's an issue of Russian behavior outside international norms and the importance of them recognizing this. And if they want to come back to be a respected and functioning member of the international community, that all needs to change.
The United States is standing by you, as you know. What were the conversations that you had with the Trump administration about their decision to expel diplomats and close the consulate in Seattle?
We talked at lots of levels to the U.S. administration. Prime Minister, I think, talked three times in all to the American president about this. And whether it was Foreign Secretary to the Acting Secretary of State here or our Defense Secretary to his counterpart or me to people in the White House and in the State Department, there was a huge amount of interaction, agency to agency as well, intelligence security agencies. And let me say, we were hugely appreciative of the decisiveness and strength that the president showed in that decision to expel 60 Russian diplomats. This was
no hesitation by the Trump administration whatsoever.
I think that the timing was about coordination with all the announcements of expulsions by Europeans, which, if you remember, it all came together on that Monday. So I think that was what determined the timing.
That will be very interesting for Americans to hear because, as you know, there has been a conversation in this country about our president's response to Russia. On the one hand, the administration is applying new sanctions. It has also said it's going to kick out these diplomats. But on the other hand, the president has been unwilling to publicly speak poorly of Vladimir Putin. So I just want to be clear. I mean, from your interpretation of how this went down, you're saying that the Trump administration never questioned the fact that it would take action against Russia.
They needed to know what our evidence was behind our attribution of this appalling act to Russia. So yes, we went through all of the reasons why we were convinced the Russians were behind it, and it was entirely reasonable of the administration to say, well, tell us everything you know about this and how it happened and why you're so sure it was Russian attribution. Once that was established, we were always confident that the administration would have our back and that would support us. And so they did. And, you know, the Prime Minister, as I said, three conversations, I think, with the president, in each of which he was supportive. He said in one of them something like, I'm going to be behind the UK all the way on this. So we have nothing but praise for the way that that he personally and the administration generally responded.
Okay, let's talk about some other issues. How about Syria, which is another topic of conversation here? A soldier from the United Kingdom was killed last week in Syria. So you have your own forces there, and so this is a timely topic for you as well. The debate now is whether or not the United States should get out of Syria, how quickly it should, and I want to ask you, what you think the right move is for the future of both your own country's involvement in Syria and also the United States.
Yeah. Look, it's understandable that there is a lively debate in all of the countries which are involved in Syria or in Iraq, or in Libya, about the extent of our involvement and the duration of our involvement. And that's normal in democratic societies. Let's remember that in Syria, we have, however, had a major success in defeating Daesh and in driving them out of Raqqa.
Or the Islamic State.
The Islamic State. Right. And it's important that we confirm and capitalize on that success and that we don't kind of let things revert. So we support what the U.S. administration has done in Syria. As you imply, we have been playing our part too.
Will your mission change anytime soon?
Well, the Islamic State forces have been defeated and driven out of Raqqa. They've not vanished from the face of the earth. So there's always a risk that they can return if there is a vacuum, if there is a space.
And we also know, sorry to interrupt you, but we also know that even if there are just tiny pockets of the Islamic State left in certain areas, it doesn't mean it's going to be easy just to finish them off. I mean, it could take years. Yeah. Isn't that fair to say?
Well, I don't know about years, but they are certainly, we would say, not finished yet. And we will be working with the administration, putting our own views on exit strategies and what we should do next to them, and trying to find a collective way forward.
Look, you're sitting here in front of me because you are in Boston to mark the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. Of course, 1998, a deal designed to end decades of violence in Northern Ireland. Did you think the agreement would hold together this long?
I remember when I was actually working in Brussels when the agreement was made, and it was quite an extraordinary moment after those decades of the Troubles. And I was hugely hopeful that it would stick. But let's be clear, it's required a huge amount of work by successive British governments.
And there have been major setbacks.
There have been setbacks, but we've overcome them, and we will overcome, I am sure, the issues that we face at the moment. But I was Europe advisor in Tony Blair's government, 2004 to 2007. I just remember how every few weeks the Northern Irish politicians would descend on Number 10, and basically for 2 days the Prime Minister and his team, his small team, would do nothing else but try, at that stage they were trying to restore power sharing and devolve government in Belfast. And they got there with, I think, the agreement in 2006.
But right now that body is not functioning.
It's not functioning. You're right. We're back into that situation. But, you know, the new generation of British leaders and politicians who are ministers who are addressing this are working extremely hard to get back to devolved government. That's absolutely our objective. You know, we don't have any wish to be running things from Westminster. And, you know, I'm optimistic that they will get there.
How much of a threat to peace will we see if there is a return with Brexit? There's a new hard border between the Republic of Ireland and the North.
Well, there's not going to be. Prime Minister has pledged absolutely there is going to be no hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Do you think people in Northern Ireland are hearing that message?
Well, we couldn't be any clearer. I mean, we've said it. I mean, it's not a straightforward issue in terms, because it's tied up with the nature of the future relationship between the UK and the EU once we've left. But I hope people in Northern Ireland will accept that when the government says something as clearly and as emphatically as we've said it, then that's what we're going to stick to, and they can trust us to one way or another deliver this.
Ambassador Kim Derrick, thank you.
Thank you very much.
California is in another standoff with Washington. This week, the Justice Department sued to block Senate Bill 50, a new law that gives California power to veto the sale of federal land. This follows the Justice Department's high-profile fight with California over its sanctuary laws that are meant to protect undocumented immigrants. California State Controller Betty Yee joins us now. Betty, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure to join you.
Why did California feel it was necessary to pass SB 50?
Well, we know here in California, we are home to more than 45 million acres of federal lands, and the California State Lands Commission, which I chair, we provide stewardship to millions of acres of state public lands, and we take our stewardship responsibilities and obligations very seriously. And this is all about really the importance of protecting our precious public lands, whether they are state-owned or federally owned, for future generations.
It could hold up a transfer or a sale of federal land. What's the fear? Why wouldn't you want the federal government to do that?
Well, you know, we believe that Senate Bill 50 was intended to do, and we support the intent, is to discourage any transfer of federal public lands to private third parties for the purpose of exploiting those resources for private gain, such as oil and gas development. But I want to just be clear, the legislation does not prevent the sale of land. Instead, it just prevents private purchasers from recording deeds to the land unless the state was allowed the opportunity to buy the land first.
So first it's really, refusal, the right I mean, of this, first refusal.
Exactly. First, exactly.
Well, the Justice Department has been very clear that it believes California is out of line here, that the land belongs to the federal government, and that the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution makes it clear that the feds have jurisdiction. How can you argue with that?
Well, you know, we look at our stewardship as being all-encompassing of public lands. And, you know, I know the federal administration has stated its intent to keep its promise not to transfer or sell public lands. And so if that's the case, then I think it's it was premature to file the lawsuit. So we have no intention of preventing any sales that certainly are broadening public interest. I know they've made a case about building facilities for the military on public lands, mm-hmm. and to the extent that that serves a larger public interest, we're not going to interfere there.
You would not interfere with any transfers that included the military?
Well, we would see what the proposal was, but if that is something that is not for private gain, that's something that we certainly would probably not stand in the way of.
There was an analysis by the state legislature before this bill was passed that said that there was a good chance it would be found unconstitutional. So with that information, why would lawmakers have pressed forward?
Again, we have that jurisdiction with respect to looking at the purpose for these lands within our authority. The land recording system is set up under state laws, so it's within our state rights to pass laws regarding recorded deeds, including those for federal lands.
As you know, the context around all of this is that the Trump administration and California have not been getting along well lately. There are dozens of lawsuits between the two jurisdictions. I mean, don't you think that anything else could be done to improve this relationship? Rather than all these legal fights?
Well, I would hope that eventually what this administration will realize in Washington is that California is a major driver of the rest of the nation economically, socially, and you know, any further attacks and singling out of California, I believe is just very, very short-sighted. We contribute a lot to the prosperity of the country. We contribute a lot with respect to the innovations. We blaze trails, and we're really just showing here that we take our stewardship responsibilities seriously, and so our leadership stands and has been clear on this front as well.
That's California State Controller Betty Yee. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Today, Chinese officials say if President Trump goes ahead and imposes the tariffs he announced yesterday on $100 billion worth of Chinese goods, then China will, quote, counterattack with great strength. Earlier this week, China announced tariffs on $50 billion in American products, including, notably, soybeans. China is the largest importer of soybeans in the world, and the U.S. is one of China's main suppliers. So if tariffs go into effect, and that is a big if, American soybean producers stand to lose a lot. But soybean farmers in another country stand to gain. That country is Brazil. Wallace Tyner is here to unpack all of this for us, or at least help us unpack it. He's professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Lisa.
How would U.S. soybean farmers feel the negative impacts of the tariff, and how would Brazilian farmers benefit?
Where it hits the ground is at the farm, and that's the group that would be affected most. U.S. production of soybeans would fall about 15%, and prices would fall. Farmers would begin to shift their production from soybeans to corn. With more corn on the market, then corn prices would begin to fall. So the group that's most adversely affected is crop producers in the Midwest. Of course, in any of these things, they're winners and losers, and the crops are mainly animal feeds. Soybean meal and corn make up a big part of the diet for most of the animals that we consume. So the livestock producers would gain because they'd have lower feed prices, but the crop producers are the big losers in this.
So crop producers, soybeans and corn included, and how about in Brazil? Brazil exports a lot of soybean. It would stand to benefit farmers there?
Yes, they do stand to benefit. Brazil, in our analysis, is the largest winner globally. In fact, we do analysis of all the kinds of impacts, export changes, production changes, price changes, and everything. But another one we do is economic well-being. What happens to the general economic well-being in different countries? And one of the fascinating things to me about this study is that the U.S. loses about $3.1 billion a year because of that tariff just on soybeans. But China also loses $3.1 billion a year. So China is a big loser in this tariff as well.
Why does China lose?
Okay, good question. China produces only about 15% of its soybeans. They import 85% of their soybeans. The cost of those imports goes up with the tariff, not only the ones that they import from the U.S., but the ones they import from Brazil and other countries. So our estimate is that the producer price of soybeans in China goes up about 5% and the consumer price up about 8%. So with all those price increases for an import that's that important, that large in the Chinese economy, they lose. So this is a lose-lose situation. The U.S. economy loses and the Chinese economy loses about the same amount. The winner is Brazil.
The winner is Brazil. To what extent? How much?
$2.7 billion per year. What happens in the case for Brazil is the acreage that we lose in the United States, Brazil expands their acreage. They have a lot of land. They have the potential to expand acreage. And over a 3 to 5 year period, they can and probably would do that if the tariff stayed in effect.
But there's a caveat to that, too. Farming in Brazil has been blamed for a lot of deforestation there in the Amazon rainforest. Does Brazil, you say they have a lot of acreage, do they have enough land to expand soybean production to fill in the gap and export more to China without knocking out more of the rainforest?
They could not displace all of U.S. soybean exports. That's a very good point. The soybean production in Brazil is not in the Amazon region. It's further south, and they have in that region, the Cerrado, they have potential to expand, say, as much as 9 million acres. That's a lot of soybeans. But it would take time. It's not instant. In fact, if the tariff went on today, it would have zero impact because today all of China's imports are coming from South America. They import from South America in the spring and summer after the South American harvest. They import from the U.S. in the fall and winter after the U.S. harvest. So a tariff today has no impact, but in 4 or 5 months, it would begin to have an impact.
And just to put a finer point on what you mentioned earlier on the question about deforestation, so you're saying that if Brazil had to expand to fill in the gap from the U.S., it would not take the place of part of the rainforest. Is that correct?
No, it's not. They don't produce soybeans in that region. It's possible that cattle grazing would expand in that region or some other changes would occur, but no soybeans are produced in that region.
When we hear about the soybean imports to China, we think about maybe tofu or soy sauce or soybeans as they are as a whole. But there are other products that soybeans make. Can you tell us what they are, especially in China?
Soybeans are 80% meal and 20% oil. The meal is a protein source that's used to feed animals. And it's very important in China for poultry and pork diets in particular. And it is absolutely essential in their livestock production system. The oil is used mainly in the human food consumption in China, as in many parts of the world. China also imports some soybean oil in addition to the whole beans from the U.S. So all of it's used, all the meal is used in the animal feed system, and the oil is used in the human food system mainly.
And one other point, why has demand for soybeans increased so much?
The soybean meal is 44% protein. It's an excellent source of protein in animal diets. And China does not produce much of it. China is determined to feed its population and is increasing the protein content of the diet. And so their demand for soybeans has just grown enormously. And the U.S. and Brazil are the leading suppliers.
Wallace Tyner, professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University in Indiana. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Good to speak with you, Lisa.
Former First Lady Michelle Obama has some words of advice for women and girls about having confidence in what they say and do. Obama took center stage at the Simmons College Leadership Conference in Boston yesterday. Simmons President Helen Drinan asked Obama if there's anything in her life that she wishes she had done differently. Here's part of her response.
Yeah, I think that I suffer from the same thing that women and girls suffer from. I mean, we second-guess our voices. We question ourselves. We are so in our heads about and so busy trying to be perfect that we don't raise our hand and ask the question. We don't interject. We don't correct a wrong when we see it happening right in front of us in the business world, in our professional arenas. And if I were to do anything over, I would do over those times when I held my tongue You know, when I second guessed my voice, when I was afraid of being wrong or looking stupid, I would do that all over again. Mm-hmm. Especially as a young girl, I would be unafraid to be wrong. I would be so brave about speaking up even more so than I did. I would be outside of my head more. I wouldn't be worried about failing. And I think for me, I had those issues when I was young. You know, I worried about getting things wrong and looking stupid and not saying things just right. Mm-hmm. And then you grow up and you sit at all these seats of power and you sit around people, you go up the ladder and you realize, gosh, a lot of these people don't know what they're doing. You know, but it doesn't stop them. You know, I have witnessed a lot of failing up that happens all over the place. And if you're not at these seats, you think they're perfect seats. You think there's some magic happening there. And it happens all over the world. People with power, with money, you know, with esteem, and you sit down and talk to them, you go, wow, is that all? Is that it? Is that what I was worried about? I didn't think I could measure up to that. And it's that lesson that I just want young women to learn. It's like, this isn't magic. You know, none of these folks out here that are running things are perfect. Mm-hmm. They fail, and they fail often. And we have to be brave enough to own our voices and put ourselves out there, to be okay with being imperfect and to be okay with the imperfections that we see in one another.
Yes.
And I, you know, if anything, that's the hope that I have for our country as we move forward.
Former First Lady Michelle Obama speaking yesterday at the Simmons College Leadership Conference in Boston.
Way back in the 1800s, a sawmill worker found some shiny nuggets at Sutter's Mill just north of Sacramento, California. Word spread, and then more than 300,000 people poured into California, hell-bent on striking it rich. The gold rush transformed the state into an economic powerhouse and established its reputation as a place where fortunes could be made overnight. These days, most people are chasing other riches. But as KQED's Matthew Green reports, a rare breed of Californian is still looking for real gold.
I'm tagging along with Shannon Poe as he explores the bottom of a small canyon on public land near the North Fork of the Merced River in the shadow of Yosemite National Park. It's close to his property, a spread he says he bought about 10 years ago with, picture this, a jar full of gold.
I found a guy that had, you know, 10 acres up here, and I offered him basically a baby food jar of gold, and he took it, and we own the property now.
Poe's a stocky guy in his mid-50s with a weathered skin and gruff manner you might expect from someone who spends a lot of time alone in the woods. He fires up a dusty Kawasaki four-wheeler, and soon we're roaring down rutted fire roads through oak and manzanita. We roll past ancient pipes and mining machines. It's a scattered collection of hulking steel carcasses hauled here 150 years ago by donkey cart and left to rust.
You can see along this wall is the remnants of the old Pony Express trail right there. See it come across?
We hop out and scamper down a makeshift trail and stop at a slow-moving creek. He reaches in the water and digs up a shovelful of rock and sand, and then filters out the sediment with his ribbed pan.
Nothing in that. I gotta get to the bottom of that crack before we're gonna really find anything.
And to find the good stuff, it really helps to know some gold rush history.
People came from all over the world. You know, there were newspaper articles in France saying that you could walk around and pick up 5-pound nuggets just laying on the ground.
But Poe says the old timers left a lot behind, especially right below where their cabins stood. That's what he's looking for.
We know that this was started to be mined in this particular area in 1851. And if they came down and they built a cabin here, there's a good chance that the ground underneath here has never been touched by human hands before.
Poe grew up panning in the streams near his hometown in Oregon. But gold fever didn't fully kick in until he came to California for a corporate security gig about 15 years ago.
I got really sick and tired of, you know, company cars and human resources and all that kind of crap. I decided to take a year off, and I had some mining claims, and we pulled over six figures in a couple of months.
He's since become something of a gold mining evangelist, supporting other small-scale prospectors in their quest. His truck is covered with a huge American flag decal, an image of the Constitution, and the tagline, "Fighting for your right to mine."
It's about freedom, man. I get to do what I want. I'm out in God's country every single day. I mean, this is where I have lunch. This is my office.
Last year was a really good one for dedicated small-scale California miners like Shannon Poe, thanks in part to the state's extreme weather patterns. The historic drought, followed by last winter's torrential rains.
Mother Nature came along, scoured all the stuff that you would have had to do all this manual physical labor for, and just cleaned it all away for us. So we just walked in and went, oh, I'm just going to dig right here. Thank you very much.
We come up to the gaping mouth of a rickety old mine that Poe estimates was dynamited out in the 1860s or 70s. The tunnel disappears quickly into darkness.
Imagine how many miners died up here in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s. And, I mean, just got crushed, and their buddies drug them out and buried them right next to the mine shaft. I wouldn't be surprised if we're 50 feet from dead people right now.
I look around, a bit uneasy. I can make out the makeshift shelves that miners chiseled into the walls to hold their oil lanterns.
If you sit here and there was absolutely no sound or anything like that, you would hear people using picks inside here. I've heard it dozens of times.
Poe claims he even once heard a banjo echoing from deep inside the mine.
And I don't know whether I believe in ghosts or not. All I can tell you is I know what I've heard, and it's really weird.
Back at the creek, Poe is wrestling a big rock. We roll it over, and he grabs some debris and pans it. He grins and hands me a speck of gold, not much bigger than an apple seed.
Not bad, $20 pan. Way cool.
I'll admit, it's a pretty far cry from the big nuggets I was picturing. But there's still a little thrill in finding even a tiny piece of the glimmering mineral lying there on the creek bed.
That's $20 right there.
Oh, yeah, easily. Thin stuff, but nice. There, you got to take that home with you. Tell everybody you found gold. You moved the rock.
I thank him for it. A good start to my kids' college fund. For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Green.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.